This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our program. It's Anything Goes Friday, although we are taking a break here for a half hour or thereabouts to talk with Irshad Manji as our great mind today in our Conversations of the Great Minds series. Her book is Don't Label Me, an incredible conversation for divided times, and it's absolutely brilliant. We made it one of our book report books that we share little clips of during our when our commercial stations are in break. Irshad, welcome to the program.
Tom, it is wonderful to be back with you. It's been a few years, so I'm glad we're catching up.
Indeed, me too. Thank you so much. So, first of all, I saw your tweet just a moment ago that you're going to come on and that you thought that Representative Omar's situation would come up. Let me just toss that to you. I'd be glad to share my thoughts on it, but you're our guest. What does all this mean to you? You should first start out by recapping very quickly for people who don't know what we're talking about, what happened.
Right. So Ilhan Omar is a freshman congresswoman from Minnesota. She is a refugee and a Somali American and a Muslim. And we should not label her just for those reasons. She is much more than that, obviously, as any human being is. That said, she is getting a ton of criticism and has been over the last couple of weeks for statements that she has made that many people believe rehash ancient ugly stereotypes about Jews. So, for example, a couple of weeks back, she said that, we should be looking into the corrupting influence of big money in politics. And she cited AIPAC, the American-Israel Political Action Committee, which is a very pro-Israel lobby here in the United States. And she cited them. But she didn't cite, for example, the NRA, the National Rifle Association, and the money, gives to politicians in order to have them vote their way, etc. She did that in her apology, but that was too late for many people. Another stereotype she's now accused of indulging in, she said on a panel the other day that she wants to challenge the pressure that forces people to, have dual loyalty, to be loyal to a foreign country, as she put it, namely Israel. And these stereotypes of Jews as not loyal citizens of the country they're living in, or Jews who buy influence through their money, these are all ways that Jews throughout history have been slandered. And many fear that that is the thin edge of the wedge, that that will, if left unchallenged, will eventually lead to the Holocaust all over again. So that's the controversy. You've asked me what I think. Well, there's lots to think about this. One is that she no doubt has, relitigated these ugly tropes about Jews. And because she does this, what seems like repeatedly, it seems that she knows what she's doing, which is very disheartening. At the same time, she has apologized in the past, and she has, along the way, raised important questions about, what many of us feel are the corrupting influences of money in politics and so forth. So the question is, how do you deal with this? Do you simply condemn her, or do you acknowledge that she's raising important questions and correct her about the stereotypes that, she has either intentionally or unintentionally, but at this point I do think it's intentionally, put out there. Precisely because, Tom, I don't believe that it's best to label people and then react on the basis of those labels. I think that we would all do well to acknowledge the important questions that she's raising generally, and then to explain to her that you can still raise those questions without indulging in these myths about Jews. And if you think that I'm sort of soft peddling it or I'm treating her with kid gloves or anything like that, just know that I would have agreed with you a few years ago. I would have simply lambasted this woman. But one of the things I've learned over the years is that if all we're doing is berating instead of relating, then we're not actually going to change anybody's mind. Nobody is insulted into taking a different point of view. And so I think by congratulating her on the important questions that she has brought up, you lower the emotional defenses of her and, importantly, her supporters, so that in another round of engagement, they'll be able to hear what you now have to say about the unacceptability of, you know, these stereotypes of Jews.
Yeah. That's quite an analysis, and it does open a whole lot of, you know, really interesting questions. For example, what other country has the equivalent of an AIPAC in the United States that has the equivalent of that kind of political influence? I don't mm-hmm. know of any. I mean, there may be one,
right.
But to the
right.
best of my knowledge.
It may be that Saudi Arabia, you know, because of its riches, which oil riches,
right.
you know, may be sloshing around with money on Capitol Hill. But that's hardly it's a dubious comparison, right? Nobody wants to be
sure.
compared with Saudi Arabia. They're as corrupt gets. So do we hold Israel to the, or the Israeli lobby
right.
to the same standard?
Well, and there's the other issue, too, that you know, my take on it originally was that she was criticizing some of Israel's policies and some of
right.
their outside influence in the United States rather than criticizing Jews, and not having grown up in the United States, not being familiar with, I mean, she didn't even grow up in the West, right? Not being familiar with this. This whole kind of psychic whatever gestalt, you know, zeitgeist mm-hmm. in which we live, she was saying things that were unintentionally anti-Semitic or could be interpreted that way. That was my take on it. I didn't think that she was being intentionally anti-Semitic, but well be wrong.
At that time, I didn't think so either. But what I did say to people who, you know, asked me what I thought was, you know, instead of censoring her, instead of bearing down on her and telling her to just shut up, what we ought to be doing is reveling in the freedom of speech that she has, because the virtue of free speech, Tom, is that people who use it and ultimately abuse it always are compelled by their freedom of speech to push the envelope too far. And at that point, we'll know if she truly is an anti-Semite.
Right.
Well, back then, I don't think it would have been fair to conclude on the basis of one or two, you know, of these statements that she was an anti-Semite. I'm frankly less convinced now. I'm more convinced that she is one simply because she continues to make statements that, again, you know, revive ancient myths about Jews.
Yeah.
And surely after the first couple of stumbles, she would have gotten a briefing from her highly educated staff about, you know, what these stereotypes are, and to avoid them as she tries to make valid points.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point. So you suggest, we're talking with Irshad Manji, the author of her most recent book, Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times, and it is an incredible conversation. You note that diversity can be both a polarizing issue and a unifying one. It's interesting, Louise and I were walking into work this morning, into the studio, and there was a penny on the ground, and I haven't seen a penny on the ground since I was a kid, and there was always this, you know, it's good luck to pick up a penny. And
right.
so I picked it up, and the back, I'd never seen a penny that looked quite like that on the back, and it's just, I guess I don't get much change these days. But on the back, it was just the shield, and it said E pluribus unum, and, you know, out of one, out of many, one. And
right.
and I said, wow, you know, they've emphasized diversity on the back of the new penny, apparently. And I thought that was kind of cool, and I was wondering when it happened and whether or not it was a political statement and what Donald Trump would think about it. let me toss that to you. We are going to hit a hard break in about a minute and a half here, but and we'll come back on the other side of it and continue our conversation.
Right.
But let me toss that to
right.
you.
Well, first of all, I did not know that a new penny was being minted, and moreover, that it would be, you know, promoting this. This is really the motto of the early American Republic: out of many, one. And as you can see, given that it was the motto for these United States, that even in the founders' time, you know, they were celebrating a degree of diversity, but not for the sake of indulging in difference. They were acknowledging that, you know, people from different regions, different traditions, different religions, different cultures are coming together to form one nation. And so as Cass Sunstein, you know, put it in this wonderful book, Why Societies Need Dissent, the framers' greatest innovation was that they relied on airing of differences. They relied on disagreement as a way to bring people together so that nobody felt unheard. That is a level of psychological intelligence that really took some special people to enact. And that was what our framers did. And if we were really living up to their legacy, we too today would be taking disagreement as an invitation to engagement, not as a reason or, frankly, an excuse to walk away or roll our eyes or hurl more labels at each other.
Except when that disagreement is, you know, patently offensive. I mean, when that disagreement is, you know, say a Nazi, you know, a neo-Nazi shouting, mm-hmm. "Jews will not replace us." Mm-hmm. You know, how else do you respond? I mean, this is a large question, I guess.
Large question, and I will say, of course, that, you know, sometimes you really do have to walk away, or if that neo-Nazi is brandishing a gun, perhaps run away. Yeah. But in my book, Don't Label Me, I actually tell the story of a white nationalist who reformed himself because he was so touched by the friendship that he was offered.
And it's an extraordinary story. Let's pick up, we'll pick up the conversation and continue the conversation in just a moment. It's 18 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Conversations with Great Minds segment with Irshad Manji, New York Times bestselling author of Don't Label Me.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back. Stick around. And welcome back. So we were talking about how to respond to people who disagree with you, and I would note that there can be a variety of different kinds of agreements. There can be disagreements
right.
that are predicated on hateful perspectives. There could be disagreements that are simply predicated on respectful and legitimate differences. There can be disagreements that are based on one or the other party believing something that isn't objectively true, but mm-hmm. they still have the belief of it. Aren't there, and those aren't necessarily categories, they're points on a spectrum. And, well, and you know, so there's potentially an infinite number of categories. How do we know how to engage or disengage
how do we know who's who, right?
Yeah, and what to do when.
Right, brilliant. So, my simple sort of answer to that, and I'll dive more deeply into it in a second, is you don't actually know who's who until you risk conversing with them. And after a few rounds, you will know if they're coming from a place of sincerity, of genuine belief in their point of view, if they're just trying to game you. So let me give you an example that we were cut off from before the break. Mm-hmm. So you asked me, right? Surely you can't, you know, simply convert someone out of being a white supremacist. As it turns out, in the book, and Don't Label Me, I tell the story of a young man who was a nationalist, a white nationalist. He was raised that way by his parents, and he reformed himself because for a number of years he was befriended on campus, on his college campus, by an Orthodox Jew who would invite this young man over for Friday night or Shabbat dinners. And knowing full well what this young man stood for, his Jewish friend nonetheless engaged in conversation with him, as did other people around the table. That's not to say that they allowed him to get away with, you know, crap. Rather, it's the way they corrected him. It's what they said and how they said it that over time built trust. And because of that trust, because they didn't jump down his throat, he realized that he really, you know, needs to be reconsidering his position. And ultimately, he did. And now he is one of the more vocal anti-racist activists in this country. So my point is that you can never write anybody off. That's not to say, Tom, that, you know, everybody in the, under the sun deserves your time and your energy. Not at all. But here's a challenge that I'd like our listeners to think about. Between now and 2020, will each of us take the time to develop just one friendship with somebody on the other side of the political aisle? Just one. And when I say friendship, I don't mean meet them for a coffee and a debate. I mean ask them questions.
Deep listening.
To what they have to say. Deep listening, and listening, therefore, to understand and not to win.
Yeah.
That way, you'll glean a lot more information from them about why they value what they value and how you can reframe your arguments down the road with those values so that they can hear them.
Amen. And your book is a great guide to this. Don't Label Me is the book. Irshad Manji is the author, who is our guest in Conversations with the Great Minds. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Our Conversations with the Great Minds segment today. Irshad Manji is our guest. Her new book, Don't Label Me, an incredible conversation for divided times. And we've been talking about, you know, engaging with people with whom we disagree and those sorts of things. You talk about, I mean, literally your title, Don't Label Me. And you made the comment earlier on about when we were talking about Representative Omar, about, you know, she's this, this, and this, but she's much more than that, and we really shouldn't just go with these labels. And yet, there is this biologically apparently hardwired thing in all of us. I'm guessing you're familiar with the white rat, black rat study that came out about 2 weeks ago. Maybe a month ago?
2 weeks ago? No, actually, I'm not. Tell me.
This is fascinating. They developed a little tube that was a trap that would hold a rat, and it could be opened from the outside by another rat. And so they put this trapped rat in, and the other rats would always let the rat out. So then they tried, but they'd always done it with white lab rats. So then they put a black lab rat in the tube. The white rats didn't let it out. They would have let it starve to death. So they flipped it and did it, you know, with black rats with a white. It's the same problem. So then they raised a litter of rat pups where they swapped out some of them with the mothers so that they grew up with, you know, white and black rats both, you know, suckling at the same mother. And those rats saved the other rat regardless of whether it was a white rat or a black rat.
And
and so, you know, this is happening at the level of DNA, basically. I mean, you know, we're mammals and rats are mammals, but there's a huge spectrum between the two of us that covers, you know, probably hundreds of millions of years of evolution. So, we only have about 2 minutes left, I'm sorry, but understanding how deeply this stuff is, you know, the instinct to label is probably tied to a survival instinct. How do we deal with it?
Exactly. You know, our ancient brains needed back on the savannah to detect every little noise and to figure out instantly if that is a threat to my security. Well, we've essentially got the same brains today, though a very, very different society. So I say let's work with biology, not against it. The first thing to do, whenever you're feeling uncomfortable because of an argument that is made and you disagree with it, take a deep breath. You're slow jamming your ancient brain. You are slowing the blood rush that is going on inside of you. And only after that deep breath do you even think about responding. And the second thing to do is to remember that just as you have this ancient brain, and nobody should be pouncing on you because of our biological proclivity to label, so you ought not to be pouncing on other people. We have to go first, and that means truly listening. And here's the thing. When we do that, Tom, when we truly listen, we are tapping into the most ironclad law of human psychology, which is if you want to be heard, you first need to hear. It's really that simple, but it's also obviously hard because you're triggered, biologically speaking, to, you know, spit back. But we can control ourselves. We are not lab rats. We do have the free will to figure out, you know, what is the best thing to do in this situation. And when in doubt, and even when not in doubt, step back and just listen. You'll be amazed how often you are listened in turn when you do that first.
Brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant. Irshad Manji, the book Don't Label Me, an incredible conversation for Divided Times. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you. I look forward to speaking again.
Me too. It's been a great conversation, and thank you again. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program right after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
So what's on your mind? Anything Goes Friday. Want to call and disagree with me? I'm here. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just for the record, I realize my guest said that she believed that Representative Omar was intentionally spouting anti-Semitic tropes. I personally disagree with that. I didn't think it was a particularly good venue to get into a debate with a guest. And she's as entitled to her opinion as I am to mine, I suppose. James Clark tweets, the shield penny design came out in 2010. So it's been around for 8 years. That's kind of cool. Thank you. So that was during the Obama administration. E pluribus unum. It's great. Out of many, one. So. In fact, also the disappearing middle class tweeted that, too. Cool stuff. Thank you very much. Anyhow, it's Anything Goes Friday, so let's pick up your phone calls. Dave in Grafford, Texas. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
I experiment with bumper stickers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been about 14 years since I had a really successful one. And I have one now that people are really liking, so I just thought I'd tell you about it.
Okay.
And it's hard to argue with, no matter which side you're on, but it has a strong message, and that is greedy people suck.
Yeah. I remember either that slogan or something very much like that from the 60s, but, you know, where occasionally you see a car with like 20 bumper stickers, it would be that one and the kind of multi-religious symbol one, you know, that spelled out something.
Yeah,
I think it spelled out peace or whatever.
I've seen the mean people suck before.
Yeah. Actually, you're right. That's the one I've seen.
But
so greedy
right
people
now,
suck.
Right now, it's a real political message that they can't argue with.
Yeah.
Greedy people suck.
Yeah, and if you wanted to make it literal, you could say greedy people suck up the wealth.
Well, that's too long for a bumper sticker in my experience, but
Yeah, I get it. That's a good one. Dave, you have a website where you sell your bumper stickers?
No, I just give them away. I've got about 100 of those if you'd like some.
That's great. Yeah, no, I'm good. But because I'm not a bumper sticker user, but I think that's great that you're doing it. Dave, thank you so much for the call and for sharing your idea with us. Paul in Lucerne, California. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, I don't think it's... Okay, let me start over again. I think it's a good idea for the Democrats not to go on Fox. Because they're just going to ask you, hey, when are you going to stop beating your wife? Questions. They're not going to be real. And then they're going to give Fox legitimacy. Fox is nothing but GOP TV, and they do not deserve legitimacy.
Well, that's the other side of the argument. And that's why I was, you know, all in favor of the Democratic Party saying, particularly after Jane Mayer's piece came out last week in The New Yorker, laying out how Fox even knew about Trump's payoffs to Stormy Daniels, which are clear violations of campaign finance laws, and an attempt to essentially rig an election, which is what Trump did. Had that come out, there's no doubt in my mind he would not even have won Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan by 10,000-15,000 votes or whatever. Or at least, you know, electoral college wise. And my argument was, and I think frankly Tom Perez's argument is, we're not going to legitimize Trump's anti-democratic partyism, and by going on their show. The caller was saying, but you know, there's millions of people, and I would say probably 90% of Trump's base who watch Fox News every single day. And by having the debate on Fox, the people would catch it.
You're not going to change those people's minds. There's psychological reasons people will stick to their positions and will fight it, even especially fight it hard when they're presented with facts contrary to what they believe. They get pleasure from defending their position even harder.
Yeah. You may well be right, Paul. You may well be right. I started out saying, don't do it on Fox. Then the caller said, hey, wait a minute, you want to be in front of that audience? And I thought, you know, that's the reason why I go on Fox. And then, you know, you point out, but you're giving legitimacy to Fox, which is one of the reasons why for a couple of years I didn't go on Fox. And, I'm...
You're a single person, though. You're not running for president.
You're correct.
So you going on Fox is a good idea. Maybe you reach somebody.
Yeah.
But for the Democratic Party to give GOPV any credibility at all is a mistake, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And let us not forget, Fox News actually went to court to sue to make sure they can make their reporters lie for them.
Well, that wasn't Fox News. That was Fox Television, which owns TV stations.
Same
difference. And that was the case down in Florida with Steve and I'm forgetting their names now.
They fired this lady because she was upset because they didn't run her story.
She and her husband. So, she was the on-air talent. He was the writer
and
producer. And in fact, if you go to, I think their website is foxrgbhsuit.com, if it's still there.
You can go to Fox and Friends in 2012. Okay, August 8th, 2012. They actually ran a story. Okay, go to Media Matters and check this out. That's where I found it. That Barack Obama kidnapped the sitting Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and threatened to kill her if Bill Clinton didn't give a good speech at the Democratic Convention.
Really?
And you can go to Media Matters Archive and look it up.
It doesn't get worse. I mean, you always think you've discovered the lowest of lows on Fox, and then they come up with another one. Paul, you make a compelling argument, and I've changed my mind again, and I agree with you. Let's see if somebody else can change my mind. You know, I don't usually change my mind, but this is one of those. Anyhow, Mike in Oxford, Florida. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Just want to say hello. I'm impressed generally with the candidates that the Democrats have, but I'm kind of also disappointed in them in one way. I mean, I can understand the traditional thing is to have your platforms or whatever your goals run for. But the one thing I would like to see somebody be realistic and say, I'm going to put those things on hold, but here is going to be my number one mission. When I get to be president, if I'm elected, I get to go in there and figure out just exactly what Trump has done and how much damage he's done to all the systems, like the State Department, the Justice Department, and so on, and I'm going to try, that will be my number one thing, is to fix any of those things up before I try to do anything else.
Right.
So what do you think about that? I mean,
I think that makes a hell of a lot of sense and should actually be a campaign position, because what it does is it highlights the damage that Trump and his administration and putting a coal lobbyist in charge of the EPA, putting an oil lobbyist in charge of our Interior Department. I mean, you know, these things are just, they're crimes in my opinion. And they are, you're absolutely right, Mike, doing extraordinary damage to this country. And the Democrats should be pointing that out. Well, they are pointing it out, but they, you know, this could be a unified kind of theme. Debbie in Lake Villa, Illinois. Hey, Debbie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I called in on Wednesday about putting up moderate candidates, and I think the court decision to give Manafort a light sentence also kind of dovetails into this, that having moderate candidates kind of suppresses the vote because people can't get excited, and also when there's decisions like Manafort getting a really light sentence or Stone not getting jailed for when he broke his gag order kind of makes you feel like your voice doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah, had any of these things, by the way, had Paul Manafort, or had he been African American, apparently, before Judge T.S. Ellis, excuse me, as was Congressman Jefferson, who got 60 months, I think the results would have been very different. Excellent point, Debbie. Thank you very much for the call. Dave in Chicago. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, I just want to do a little rant with you about anti-Semitism. When I was a kid, and we had Temple on Saturday. I went to Temple, came out of the Temple for Saturday school, and asked my mom, hey, Mom, why are we at war? Well, she slammed her brakes on the car and looked back at me and said, we are not at war. Israel is at war. We are Jews and we are Americans. And I just wanted to say, look, this anti-Semitism thing, AIPAC is pro-Israel, not anti-Jew. And it's a two different things.
Well, nobody would think that AIPAC was anti-Jew. I mean,
but these comments about this anti-Jew statements, Jewish statements, I don't believe them. I think she was bringing a point in that AIPAC is influencing electors through money, and that it is pro-Israel, which a lot of people equate as pro-Jewish, and the two are...
Yeah, I think those are the points that Representative Omar was trying to make. I do think that some of the things that she tweeted and has said historically could be interpreted as being anti-Semitic, and certainly, you know, and certainly, obviously, some people did interpret them that way and go after her. You know, Brett Stevens wrote a piece about it in the New York Times. Now, Brett used to work for AIPAC, so that kind of colors that. But, you know, still, I'm inclined to think that she just didn't grow up with that kind of cultural understanding or perspective that, you know, the rest of us did. And therefore, she basically made a mistake. And that she, going forward, would probably not be making that mistake and would, you know, include the NRA along with a criticism of AIPAC, for example. You know, out of an abundance of caution, just knowing that you've got AIPAC and its partisans, you know, kind of waiting to pounce, essentially, particularly on somebody who's a Muslim and who has power. Because of their, you know, their concern that perhaps that person is harboring sentiments, with the citizen, people who live in Gaza and things like that. Dave, thank you for the call. Spot on. It's okay. I think it's entirely appropriate and important to be unafraid about criticizing the policy of any government, including our own. But to equate that with criticizing a people, that's a whole different thing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls and Anything Goes Friday right after this. And welcome back. David in Oceanside, California. Watch us on Facebook Live. Hey, David, what's up? David, your phone is just breaking up horribly. I'm going to put you on hold. Shira, David is on line 7, and maybe you guys can figure out what's going on and you can get a cleaner signal there. Greg in Tum Tum, Washington. Am I saying it right, Greg?
Yeah, Tum Tum.
Hey, what's up?
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to talk about the electrification of America and the world. The other day you were talking with Julio, and it came on like he was saying stuff like, yeah, right, show me a semi that can run on battery power. Well, right now, there's a company called Nikola Motors that builds a hydrogen fuel cell that runs an electric motor that they will be coming out in April. And they have taken orders, and they're back-ordered. They're plugged. They've got lots of them coming. Toyota and Kenworth are building their own fuel cell semi-truck. There's buses that are being run right now in California and around the world that run on fuel cells.
Is all this hydrogen, Craig?
Yes.
That's interesting. How And how is the hydrogen being acquired? Just through electrolysis? Electricity? Electrolysis of water?
That's in the future. Right now, most of the hydrogen is done through steam reformation, but that's changing quickly.
Yeah. And are you seeing, or is Europe seeing, and are we seeing, for that matter, truck stops starting to have hydrogen refill stations?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nikola Motors is, they have a huge deal with Budweiser. And they are putting up the hydrogen stations along the Budweiser routes.
Huh.
The hydrogen stations are coming, and that's probably the biggest drawback to hydrogen right now is the infrastructure is not
sure,
there.
Sure, it's the same with electric. Louise and I have a plug-in hybrid Toyota Prius, and it'll go about 30 miles on a charge. And we went to a nearby town, it's about 26 miles away, for dinner and to check out the town and check out an interesting restaurant there a week or so ago. And a block and a half away from the restaurant, there was an electric car charging station where I could plug my car in and recharge it. So we made the entire trip without using a drop of gasoline. And here in Oregon, most of the electricity is from the Bonneville Dam. You know, it's very, very clean power. And that was kind of cool. But there's other places that we travel to where there isn't a charging station nearby. And I'm willing to walk 4 or 5 blocks out of my way, or maybe even 6 or 8 blocks. But, although if the weather's bad, it becomes more of a challenge. But I'm really looking forward to the day where there's just electric charging stations all over the place for cars. And apparently hydrogen at all the truck stops along those routes. That makes so much sense. And you can create hydrogen very easily by just, running a small electric current through water. It doesn't even have to be pure water.
Yeah, right now there's a company, I don't really want to say companies that are publicly traded, but that makes hydrogen from solar panels.
Yeah,
and
using...
Check out...
Go ahead.
Fuel Cells Works is a great website to get up to speed on hydrogen.
Great. Okay, thank you, Greg. Yeah, I've often thought that hydrogen would be, one of those transitional, if not ultimate, fuels of the future, as it were. The Hindenburg aside. Welcome back. It's, by the way, International Women's Day, or is it International Working Women's Day? This debate has been going on here between Nate and Sean for all day here in the studio. The bullet here, I've got a publication from Vladimir Lenin on International Working Women's Day, and the Guardian International Women's Day, but anyway, a tip of the hat to all the women out there, and what can I say? If you wanted to call and talk about it, go for it. It apparently started out as a socialist holiday, just like Mother's Day started out as Mother's Day for Peace. It started out as a socialist holiday. I mean, literally, the woman who wrote the poem, the Star Spangled Banner, I believe. No, America the Beautiful. She wrote one of those things. She was the founder of Women's Day, which was, also a socialist holiday. Chris in Corrales, New Mexico. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick question for you. Out here in New Mexico, I'm seeing commercials with lawyers running saying if you've used ground up and you have cancer, get on board with our lawsuit.
Right,
right behind it, another advertisement for Roundup for sale.
Amazing.
So tell me what the deal is with that. Are these just ambulance chasers, or is this a real deal?
No, it's a real thing. There was a successful lawsuit a few months ago. It's, of course, being challenged, and I'm guessing Monsanto will take it all the way to the Supreme Court. But there was a multi-million-dollar settlement given to a man who had worked in the fields for years and years, as a laborer of agricultural worker who developed cancer, and the European Union has identified Roundup glyphosate, the principal ingredient in Roundup, as a potential carcinogen, and I believe the state of California has as well. So this is I can't guarantee that if you sign up for one of these lawsuits, if you have a cancer that they think they can tie back to Roundup, that you will necessarily end up with a multi-million-dollar settlement. Supreme Court might blow this whole thing up, and other courts may find differently than that court did, but there is a precedent, Chris.
there is family, my brother's family on the other side had a son, or his son died working in the fields, and the father that owned the farm worked in the fields, and they blatantly said it was from the chemicals they dealt with in day-to-day life, Roundup and all the fertilizers and things like that, and it's almost like, well, you drew the short straw, so too bad.
Well, have them, you know, to the next time those lawyers run their ad on TV, write down the phone number and pass it along.
Well, thank you for your time, Tom.
Sure, and usually, by the way, Chris, these personal injury lawsuits, the lawyer only gets paid if they win. So the risk to the risk to the client, I mean, if they ask for money up front, that's a whole completely different thing. That may even be, you know, a lawyer who's hustling you. But if they're saying, we will do this, because I went through this with my father with mesothelioma, and, you know, we hired a lawyer to try to sue the asbestos companies. And he got, you know, what at the end of the day was a little over $100,000 for my dad, which was not a small amount of money for my father and mother. And my mother lived, you know, outlived my dad by about a decade. And it was useful to have that money. So the lawyer basically, you know, cost nothing. And then when the settlement happened, I think he took half or something, maybe a little less than half. So how it works. So good luck, Chris. Good talking to you. David in Oceanside, California. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I have something to say about climate change. And, you know, at first this is going to make you want to say, wait, but just let me finish. I don't believe in climate change or that humans are causing it. What I know is that over the last several decades, we've been taking core samples in the ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland. And looking through the layers, we've been able to go back about 1 million years and see that the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere have had a natural fluctuation of between about 200 and 250 parts per million. Now, in the last 200 years, we've been able to directly sample the atmosphere and see that in the last 200 years, it's gone from about 250 to, I think we're right at about 400 parts per million now. And in that same last 200 years, we've been digging and pumping this stuff out of the ground. It's been buried under the ground for hundreds and hundreds of millions of years and burning trillions and trillions of tons of it into the atmosphere. So I don't believe it. I've seen the evidence, and the evidence is very compelling that, you know, the...
So is what you're challenging, just to get this clear, and because we've only got 40 seconds until we hit the end of the hour here, David, is what you're challenging the word believe, that I should simply say, yeah, instead of saying I believe in climate change, I should simply say climate change is a fact. It's not even something you believe in or don't believe
in. It's a fact, and we should understand
it's a measurable, observable fact.
Right, and my point about this is that there are a lot of people who do believe it, and unfortunately, there's a lot of what I call technological snake oil out there, people wanting to push essentially perpetual motion machines.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an engineer. I understand that this doesn't work, and I believe in alternative energy sources. I think we should explore them, but I think people have to be careful that there's a lot of hucksters out there selling stuff that is unrealistic.
Yeah, and on the other hand, there's a lot of stuff out there that's extraordinarily realistic that's being continually minimized and diminished by the fossil fuel billionaires and the oil barons.
Solar cells on my roof.
Yeah, exactly. Point, case in point. Yeah. And I talk about, you know, what's going on in Germany with you know, conservative on this program, and oh well, we're not Germany, thank God, right? Really? What is it? Anyhow, David, thank you for the call. It's an excellent point. Rather than saying, you know, I believe in climate change, just say this isn't an issue of belief. It's observable fact.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.